I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Gregory Heltman. He's founder and general director of the Santa Fe Symphony, and Chris Moore. He's a professor at the Santa Fe Institute. Now, the Symphony and the Santa Fe Institute come together just about every year to do a program called Voyages of Discovery. We're on the fourth voyage of discovery now. It's called The Majesty of Music and Mathematics, and it's an event at the Lenzig Performing Arts Center on November 2nd at 7:30. That's Saturday night. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be here.
Thanks.
So this is a kind of a multimedia presentation. How have these collaborations evolved over the last few years?
Our first time out of the gate, when we did the Darwin and Mendelssohn, it was in honor of the 200th anniversaries of their births. There was a presentation with two actors of letters and writings from both Darwin and Mendelssohn. Although they never met each other during their lifetimes, their parallels in their lives were quite inspiring. And then there was additional narrative from David Krakauer, who was at the Institute at that time, and by our then music director, Stephen Smith, and we played a great selection of Mendelssohn's music at that. So it was all live, and since then we've added more and more video and live demonstrations, so certainly which we'll be doing for our music and mathematics program.
So when we think about music and mathematics, have you, Chris, been studying the mathematics of music? Is that a specialty of yours?
It's not a specialty, but I mean, certainly both music and math have been loves of mine ever since I was a kid. And the reason I was excited to work with Gregory and the Symphony on this concert is that there's a side of mathematics that many people don't know. They don't get to see it in school. It's not the you do your arithmetic problem and you get the right answer or wrong answer side. It's the mathematics is about finding hidden patterns. It's about creativity. It's about the tension between having things fall into place and being surprised by the way things turn out. It's finding patterns in nature, in the abstract, in living things, in the movements of heavenly bodies in the solar system. And so I really wanted to get across to people the fact that maybe you're not a mathematician, maybe you think you don't like math, but when you listen to a great piece of music, whether it's classical or popular, the part of your brain that's lighting up, that's doing the work, and that's experiencing that pleasure is really the same part of the brain that scientists and mathematicians use all the time when they look for hidden patterns in all the things that they study.
Is that, like, have people looked at your brain and seen what lights up when they listen to Beethoven or Metallica and then
I'm not going to comment on the fancy magnetic resonance images or whatever, but I can tell you that for me, in my brain, I can feel those same things working. I spent a little while as an amateur composer in college, and I'm still an amateur listener. And
is there such a thing as an amateur listener?
Well, okay. I guess I don't get paid for it, so that means I'm an amateur. Anyway, so, I can feel the same...
Or a professional listener? Anyway, go ahead.
I would love to be a professional listener. So I can feel the same gears turning. And so we're going to talk about how the connection between music and mathematics goes back thousands of years to Pythagoras, and how Bach used symmetry in his music, how even in the Harry Potter theme today and in the Mission Impossible theme, composers are using mathematical ideas. They might not even know it themselves, but they're using the ratios of rhythms and prime numbers and the ratios that Pythagoras and his followers discovered in the chords that sound good to us. And they're using these things to make music that stirs our brains and our hearts.
So what are the features of music that lend themselves to mathematical study?
Well, I don't want to give away the whole concert, but I mean, so Pythagoras and his followers realized that a lot of the intervals or chords that make sense to our ears are ruled by these simple ratios. So, for instance, when you have a low C and a middle C, those are an octave apart, that turns out to be exactly a 2-to-1 ratio in their frequencies. A lot of the other things that we listen to, like in a C major chord, lurking in that chord are these simple fractions, like 4-to-3 and 3-to-2. And somehow these simple fractions make sense to our ears. I don't think anyone really knows why. You know, maybe it's because that when you play a note on a musical instrument, it's not just the frequency that you hear. Hidden inside that are all its, some people call them harmonics or overtones, all the multiples of that frequency. And that somehow rules how they harmonize with each other.
Right.
And then we also have that in rhythm. You know, when we have a waltz, or, you know, with 3 beats per measure, or a lot of pop music has 4 beats per measure. And occasionally when composers are trying to throw us for a loop, they have 5 or 7 beats per measure. And that sounds jazzy to us.
Or if you're Balkan, it sounds perfectly normal.
If you're Balkan, it sounds perfectly normal, or the grape leaf dance in Greece, I think. That's
right,
a nice 7 beat.
But the 5-4 beat is used to great effect by many composers to describe an impending doom or danger, such as Holst did in his Planets, and as Chris mentioned earlier, the Mission Impossible theme by Lalo Schifrin, which we'll be playing. And it's fascinating how that being thrown off. And Chris, it reminds me of your exploration of the irrational number in the tritone, and how that really also leads us to more exciting, unusual music.
Yeah, so composers often create tension and then resolve it. So when they want to tell a tragic story, or as Gregory just said, when there's a sense of menace or strangeness, they'll use these chords and intervals that don't fall into those classic patterns. And then at the end, they'll relax it back. They'll bring us back home. And that sense of finally having a pattern fall into place and work out in the end is really the same feeling that scientists and mathematicians have when the pattern they were looking for in the data or in the natural world finally falls into place and the theory works out. And it's that same sense of resolution and relief.
We're talking to Chris Moore and Gregory Heltman about the majesty of music and mathematics. Something that I find interesting is that with everything you're saying, which is very resonant to us, and there will be a lot of demonstrations of this at the event at the Lenzic on Saturday, there's also the reality of that some of this isn't universal. In other words, different cultures hear the same notes very differently, or the same intervals, or the same music very differently, or somebody in our culture who had lived 500 years ago might hear the same piece of music differently than we hear it now.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, I mean, there's a kind of, yes, this all fits into the beauty of mathematics and therefore is entirely universal, but it isn't.
Well, I think, so there are things that are and things that aren't. The 12-note scale that we're used to is not universal. But if you look at the pentatonic scales that you get, for instance, in Balinese music, if you look at the intervals between those tones, you get the same ratios that we have. They have octaves, they have fifths. I agree that it's probably just culturally contingent that major chords sound happy to us and minor chords sound sad. But rhythms are universal. I think every culture has, you know, loves to hear regular rhythms, loves to beat on a drum, and loves to break that rhythm up into smaller, more complicated parts. So I think there are those aspects of it that are truly universal.
And while different cultures may in fact divide the scale differently than we do in the West, there is a consonant to these notes. And with modern analytical equipment, we can see where those consonants arrive, where the harmonics overlap, the sympathetic vibrations overlap. And I submit that humankind finds those consonants pleasurable, whether it's at a pentatonic scale or a chromatic scale, the West. And I think that's the fundamental commonality we have when we enjoy music or play music, whether you're in Ethiopia or Japan or the United States.
When you were coming up as a musician, Gregory Heltman, were you learning the mathematics of music at all?
Very simple mathematics and fractions. The 2-4 time, 3/4 time, dividing those up into 8th note, 16th note, 32nd notes, and 64th notes. But I spent more time learning to play my trumpet than I actually did taking much mathematics beyond Algebra 2. I did try statistics in college, and so diving into this subject back in the summer of 2011 was a very steep learning curve, just so I could be familiar with the terms of art. I had no presumption that I, or pretense that I was going to become expert in these fields, but it was important. We have a great advantage with Chris's enormous musical background and training as we're talking about repertoire that we're going to play and how we're going to present different things. And so this has been very helpful to have that for this project.
I think it's, I mean, with all respect to science and mathematics, I think that part of this, part of looking at this is realizing that you really, I mean, there's all this mathematical background to music, but you don't actually have to know it to be a great player.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
true.
It's just there, and becoming a player and becoming a musician, essentially becoming an artist, is another thing entirely.
Well, I've thought about that extensively since the beginning, and that is, it seems to me that the written language of music, those notes on the page, and whatever symbolism evolved earlier than our modern notation, were ways for humankind to describe their physical world, of sound, of singing, of drumming. And I don't think I ever asked Chris this, but I will ask him now. Do you think it's a fair parallel to say that the development of mathematics by developing numbers, that you have these things, and there's a thing here on my right, a thing on my left, that's two, was a similar process of developing a language to describe our physical world?
I don't know. There's a lot of debate about this, whether we, whether our brains are tuned into abstract structure in and of itself, or whether we see those things in the physical world around us, right, rather than in a pure mental world. For me, mathematics is all about doodling and holding shapes in my hands and trying to hold them in my mind, so I tend to think very physically. But not everybody does. I think one amazing thing about the human brain is, you know, we evolved to see tigers in the grass, right, and to find food. But yet, somewhere along the way, we also evolved to see and to love abstract structures. So, you know, why is it that in much of the Pueblo pottery around here, you have beautiful geometric structures? Why is it that when people build cathedrals, they often, like in the Alhambra in Spain, they cover the walls with these beautiful geometric patterns? There's something about that that speaks to us. It's not cold. It's not separate from the physical world. It somehow echoes of what we see in the physical world. And of course, these patterns are all around us. My daughter and I love picking up pine cones and seeing that if you count the spirals, you almost always get the same numbers, 5 and 8, or 8 or 13. You get these things called Fibonacci numbers. There's a beautiful explanation for that. Why do pine cones and sunflowers do that? So, but there's something about our brains that latches on to the abstract as well as the organic.
Well, doesn't the etymology of abstract mean lifted from the real world?
You know more Greek or whatever that is than I do.
Let me look it up. but I think that, for example, Pueblo pottery is such a great example because there was a lovely exhibition at the New Mexico Museum of Art in which the curator talked about what the symbolism was and what the nature of these pots was, and that they actually represented something very real in the real world, but they looked to our eyes to be totally abstract. And I think that happens quite a lot in apparently abstract things. They are representations of the real world in some way.
But they do sometimes lift off and have a sense of their own, right? I mean, you can count pennies, but numbers also have this life of their own when you sort of lift them up from being pennies. And a lot of the beauty and joy kicks in at that point, too. So there's.
And I suppose the same goes for music. I mean, when you talk about melodies, they don't represent anything if they have no words. They're
That's
inherently
an interesting perspective. when I think of a melody, I see it in my head, and it means something to me. It's a fascinating perspective to ponder.
Something emotional question, or...
Something emotional or some past experience or some future possibility. We always talk about the earworm when we hear a song or a melody that we just can't get out of our head.
And it's usually when we hate.
Possibly it gets to be when we hate it. And then there's some melody that comes to our head that we might have heard somewhere, we don't remember where, and it can become an earworm, to use that colloquial term. The idea that music gives us the opportunity to express in another manner our emotional intention, I think is very powerful and is predictive. And I find that many areas of mathematics are also predictive. And I think it's allowed us to develop the digital electronic instruments that are so widely used to produce music today. And our concept of melodies have changed. When we were talking about the repertoire for this program, we talked about music by Milton Babbitt, who did a lot of what we call computer music. And then we also talk about Zanucki. Zanucki's music is very, it's complex. It's almost atonal because he uses all the tonalities possible in the Western scale, many times simultaneously. And to the inexperienced listener, it sounds cacophonous. But it is also, it's so complex that it's interesting. If you will, it's abstract, which draws us in, to bring it back to that discussion.
We're talking to Gregory Heltman and Chris Moore about the collaboration between the Santa Fe Symphony and the Santa Fe Institute, Voyages of Discovery, the Majesty of Music and Mathematics. What did you mean a moment ago when you said that music could be predictive?
Music can be predictive. When we think about a regular 18th century harmonic structure in theory, the most simplistic viewpoint is the 5-1 ending to the piece of music. What, those are musical terms, meaning we start with a G, which is five notes above a C. And in our ear, we want to end up on C being the beginning note that we started the song with. The same way with some church hymns, we have the 4-1 ending or cadence, which is the amen cadence, if you will. So when we land on that chord and it doesn't resolve, our heads predict that it will. Modern composers play with us and they take us someplace else.
Right.
And so that is what Chris has explored for the mathematical side as well as the musical side, this idea of patterns and surprises. And this is what I meant by this idea that music can be predictive.
When you listen to a piece by Bach, right, he has these motifs that repeat. There's a theme that you recognize. So some of the time you feel like you know what's going to happen next, and it does, and you're happy. But he also changes it up, you know, does a strange key change. I mean, Bach is really, you know, he's much less predictable, I think, than people think. And so he'll suddenly play this theme in a different way, like upside down, backwards, slowed down, sped up. And so there's this pleasant tension between feeling like you know it's going to happen and feeling surprised. And you get this even in pop music. You know, you listen to the radio, there's, you know, there's a theme, there's a melody, there's a pretty steady rhythm. But, you know, if that was all it was, then it would be kind of boring. So there's a key change. There's a different verse. There's something different about the way it's produced that gives you that hook, right? Our brains want that hook. And so going back and forth between that predictability and that surprise, it keeps us on our toes. Somehow that's what really keeps our brains engaged with the music.
What you're saying reminds me of something that I heard from an African person who was talking about the kinds of African rhythms that bring people into a trance state. And it's regular, 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 and then suddenly there's an irregular beat, and all of those irregularities are what bring people into a different state of mind. And if you think about trance states, that's like switches, and I don't know what they are, but there's some kind of, something happens in your brain, and they actually kind of have it down to a science where they know how to produce those changes.
Oh.
So let's talk for a moment about fractals. I was thinking, I've had the privilege of reading the script of the event before it came on stage, and so I won't give too much away. But I mean, most people who have seen fractals think they're so beautiful. They're visual. Right. There's visual things, and it's almost like hard to understand why they're so incredibly beautiful. But there's a very clear mathematics behind them. So you've got the math, you've got the visual. Is there a mathematical equivalent of fractals, for example, in music?
Yeah, totally. I mean, so first of all, for people who are not familiar with them, a fractal is this object that when you zoom in on it, it looks the same as it did before, where each part looks like a smaller version of the whole. And I think part of the reason we love to see these is that they happen a lot in the natural world. You know, you look at a fern, and each little bit of it is like a tiny version of the entire fern's structure, with a central stalk and things hanging off it. That pattern is repeated in each of those stalks, and even in each of the little stalks hanging off those stalks. And we see this kind of what mathematicians consider a kind of symmetry, really, but we see it all over in the natural world, and in coastlines, in clouds, even in broccoli. So now, I think people didn't really think about this very much in mathematics until the 20th century. We started seeing all these beautiful images, but musicians and composers have been doing this for a long time, right? This is what Bach is doing when he takes his theme and he speeds it up or he slows it down and he makes it harmonize with a larger, grander version of itself or with a smaller, sped-up version of itself. So he's repeating that same motif, not just in different places in the music, but at different scales from the large to the small. So that's just one of many analogies that we found when we put the script together.
One of the exciting parts of the program to demonstrate the symmetry and fractal aspect of music is the contrapuntist number 7 from The Art of the Fugue. And it is fascinating. Each contrapuntist, which is an exercise in this book, is a different effort of augmenting the theme, diminishing the theme rhythmically or harmonically. And so we will be able to demonstrate how the main theme, which is da 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 da, that's the way the theme, it goes upside down, da 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 da, and then we stretch it out, da 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 da, and all these themes are going on simultaneously, and it sounds amazing as the Mandelbrot graphic that we're so familiar with.
Very interesting.
Even in Beethoven's Fifth, right, you've got that ba 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 ba, but then he does that again. He does it faster, he does it slower in the bass, and this pulls the piece together. But, you know, it's not just going to be great music and awesome video presentations. There's going to be hands-on, on-stage, physical demonstrations with PVC pipes and a theremin.
And a theremin. We're fortunate in Santa Fe to have one of the preeminent repairers of early 20th century electronic musical instruments. That would be Andy Barron. And he has one of the last remaining RCA theremins.
Good heavens.
And we're figuring out how to bring that such a delicate instrument to the stage at the Lenzing. But he'll be doing a theremin presentation. And it is the next step from the analog instruments that required a vibrating reed or air blowing across a hole in the flute or us hitting something. It's vibrating radio waves that are being manipulated. So, Chris, do you think it's fair to describe it as still an analog instrument, even though it's electronic?
Yeah, it's not electronic in the sense of digital the way we have today. But yes, it's electric. It's using the waves in the, literally using the fact that electricity can flow partly through the air. So by moving his hands or her hands, in fact, Clara Rockmore was a great virtuoso of this instrument. The performer can adjust both the pitch and the loudness, all without even touching the instrument. And we've heard this a lot in horror movies, the woo.
Right.
But there was a time when people were writing serious symphonic works for it, and it was possibly being considered to become part of the orchestra.
And it was in the Beach Boys song Good Vibrations.
That is actually, according to Andy, not exactly true. They created a similar instrument in the studio, but it wasn't an honest-to-God theremin
that had been created. That's an urban legend, then.
Right.
It was theremin-like.
It was theremin.
Same basic principle.
Right? Thereminish.
Thereminish, okay.
Well, the program is called The Majesty of Music and Mathematics, Voyages of Discovery 4. It's Saturday, November 2nd at 7:30 at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. It's a collaboration of the Santa Fe Symphony and the Santa Fe Institute. Chris Moore is a professor at the Santa Fe Institute. Gregory Heltman is founder and general director of the Santa Fe Symphony. Thank you both very much for being with us. Will we see you both on stage?
Yes,
absolutely.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio
Thank you.
Cafe.
Thanks.